your scent upon my pillow, and then I'll say goodbye to your whispers in my dreams. And then our lips will part in my mind and in my heart, 'cause your kiss went deeper than my skin. Piece by piece is how I let go of you. Kiss by kiss will leave my mind.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connection Sunday edition. Today's date is 18th of November 2007. Of course, my name is Daryl Bradford Smith. It's great to have you here on the French Connection, listening in again to these most important of broadcasts. We have a returning guest, someone who's been with us at least four or five times as an important source for a lot of research information and historical information. His name's David Pidcock. He's been a participant in many of the world's attempts at rationalizing some of the criminality in the banking structure and in the monetary system, and he has been done extensive research on the history of banking and money in the world. And we at the French Connection are hoping to bring some understanding to this crisis, because there is certainly a serious crisis unfolding all around us. Its seriousness is going to be felt and better understood as the days ahead, you know, start really unwinding some of this, these subprime loans. And frankly, the subprime part of this is really the smallest part once you get into the mess. But without any further delay here, I'm going to bring my guest up. His name is David Pidcock. David, are you with me?
Yes, I'm with you, Daryl. Yes, thank you.
Well, great to have you here. You know, we have been working together for some time now, and I'm very good friends with Mohammed Rafik, who has been instrumental in informing my listeners about the banking system. And in your view, is he a qualified expert?
Oh, I think far more qualified than I, because he was with the Bank of England. He designed some of their trading models, and he's an exceedingly capable young man with a massive technical information, and also a good political view of things. And he and I worked together putting together with James Gibbs-Stewart, the defense for Mahathir, which enabled Malaysia to survive the Asian meltdown, you know, in the 90s.
Well, that's right. So, and that Asian meltdown, David, was, in fact, really, I think, a precursor or just a rehearsal for this big mess here. I think that what we're looking at right now is an international implosion of world finances. And at a level I've never even imagined. Do you want to give a little bit of your historic referencing to how this whole mess actually has repeated itself throughout history?
Well, I've literally finished, in the last year, 10 years of editing of a very important set of books worked by a man who called Arthur Swan. And he's written prepared a book based on his life's research into the history of the abuse of money from Plato to NATO, which is entitled The Other Road to Serfdom. Professor A wrote a book called The Road to Serfdom, in which he identified Marxist socialism as the road to serfdom, conveniently forgetting or conveniently eliminating or failing to refer to the point that unregulated capital is the road to serfdom. And so Marxist socialism, of course, came out of that. So From Plato to NATO and Beyond is the subtitle. But historically, we can go from, say, 2400 BC till the present day and find the meltdown in society. We can find civil war all emanating from a failure, not of economics, but a failure in money supply, from which the conflicts have always arisen. Debt and compounding of debt by interest has been the real poison that destroyed most of the civilizations before. So this current meltdown is clearly predicted, clearly understood and anticipated. And Professor Bernard Leiter, who attended and gave evidence at the House of Lords meeting some years ago, pointed out that the present system is so unstable that it could melt down in 2 hours and they couldn't actually stop it with all the things they put in place. So, but this is a rerun of history. I can show you the catalogue going back to the Roman period and all the way through history, where there's been a failure or a withdrawal of money, which of course has always caused the meltdown and the destruction of business and society.
Now, are the people involved in these meltdowns, the controllers or the people in charge, have they been from a similar background, or are they different groups, each mostly the same, or what is your research showing you?
We have indeed the same groups of people from the time of the Bible, but this is pre-biblical. And there's a brilliant book called The Lost Traditions of Biblical Debt Cancellation. But on the front is a cuneiform script from 2400 BC in Lagash in Sumeria, which of course is present-day Iraq. We would call it Mesopotamia. But debt was automatically cancelled in the seventh year. Debt was never allowed to go beyond 7 years, because what comes with the debt is then alcoholism, child abuse, divorce, gambling, all these things come into a society, and it's self-destruction from within because of the debt. Now, of course, being an American yourself, I have a great admiration for the American Constitution, which, of course, has the solution, but, of course, it was castrated in 1913 when the Fed was established. But listen, Thomas Jefferson made a very clear statement. He said, the modern theory for the perpetuation of debt has drenched the earth with blood and crushed its inhabitants under burdens of accumulating. Now, it was called the modern theory, but it is the continuing perennial theory of not wishing to cancel debt, when in actual fact it is the wisest thing economically to do. Otherwise, we see what's happened with this, as somebody said, from the subprime to the ridiculous. We've now ended up but this is history repeating itself. It's not new, and it will continue whatever we have this system of interest and compound interest, and governments borrowing rather than creating the money they require and spending it into circulation.
We can go back to biblical times and see that Christ himself talked about the Pharisees and about their wicked use of their control of certain monies, and then forcing the taxpayers to pay in their own coined money, and then making it scarce. Of course, that was maybe not the exact thing that happened, but rather maybe an example or a parable of how scarcity of supply causes criminal usury. And do you find that's the same group doing this, or is it a different group? I mean, are we talking about Jewish elements here involved in this?
No, we have to go be pre-Judaism, because remember, Judaism only really is become like that by name about 800 B.C. But it is it's human nature, and that you have a system of belief which believes in, say, let's say the Ten Commandments, of which I'm sure we would all sign up to.
Yep.
Look at Moses was the one who brought the law, the Mosaic law, but this is a continuation. Common sense runs throughout history, and the Mosaic law has the great wisdom in it, and it continues with that which was practiced in Sumeria, Lagash, and in Mesopotamia, in which in the seventh year of the year of Jubilee in the Bible, debt was cancelled in the seventh year. And if you look at anything, if you take a piece of paper and you try to fold it and double fold it, you will never get beyond seven. You cannot fold anything beyond seven times. So that it's like you have seven Daves or seven notes in the octave, and then you have to change key. Unless you cancel debt, it destroys and blocks everything. So this is like a law. And there's a very important Kondratiev curve, which is he was a famous Russian physicist and mathematician, shows that there is a cycle. And I had a friend called Frank Muncaster in Manchester, and his father and he followed Kondratiev's curve, selling all their plant and machinery and clearing the warehouse every 7 years in preparation for the downturn, which comes because of, as Jefferson said, the modern theory of perpetuating debt has destroyed, and it destroys everything regardless of whether we're 2400 BC or we're in 2007 AD. The same mathematics and the same science works. You cannot continue without destroying the society and the environment because of debt and compounding debt with interest.
Now, what we see here is that there are people who will, when the dust settles, emerge with probably more power, not less, Each major shake to a financial system that I've studied always leaves the control and power in fewer hands than before the implosion. In other words, there's less freedom, not more, at the end of it. And I'm wondering if that's what your research finds as well.
Indeed, it does. And Jefferson, again, identifies this, let's call it the conspiracy theory, that things that happen periodically with a similar bunch of people, of course, show that there is a conspiracy. Now, we're encouraged to believe that there isn't one, but, of course, the genius of, let's say, Satan is that convincing half the world he doesn't exist and the other half that they're not following him. This issue is one that is clearly understood. It was understood by Keynes, by Churchill, all the way back to Aristotle, all the way back. But they go to the Bible, and the betrayal of Moses was by his cousin Korah, who was also a Levite from his own tribe. And once the prohibition came in Leviticus and in Deuteronomy, that interest would not be permitted. Then, of course, the rebellion began by Korah, who, again, was from the tribes of Israel. But this is pre-Israelite. But the people who, if you have the synagogues of Satan, then you have people who will always endorse this, because the key to the game is power. And the key to power is, in the present day, is money. But the ultimate objective is power. So Mosaic law, the opening up of the earth and the swallowing of Korah, was an example. But this then continues. You talk about Jesus, peace be upon him. He walked on water, they all applauded. He fed the 5,000, absolutely everybody applauded. Only when he touched the money changers in the temple was he in serious trouble. Because you cannot touch the money. You can walk on water, feed the 5,000, whatever you wish to do. But as the key was that the conflict in Ireland would still be going on had the IRA not bombed the city. Because you can do anything. You can destroy Warrington. You can blow up people, innocent people. But the city was the only place that settled, and that otherwise we would still see the conflict in Northern Ireland continuing today.
Yep. Well, interesting to note here that as this unfolds throughout our history, we keep revisiting the same errors over and over again, and somehow we are not well schooled in the dangers of this, because the people who do control the levers of money and power don't want us to know that this is the inevitable conclusion to a fiat money system or to a debt-based money system, and yet the Muslim world has outlawed it for some time.
Yes, they have outlawed it, but they are the worst perpetrators of usury in the world today. There isn't an Islamic bank. There isn't an Islamic bank, I can tell you. They may have the name over the door, but I can assure you that there are no banks functioning according to the Sharia. And from the past 30 years of my attending meetings throughout the Islamic world, the African Islamic world, Malaysia, etc., the Muslims have become the worst than all the other groups put together, because they have a prohibition in their book that says if you do not give up what remains of your demands for interest or usury, expect war from him and the messenger. And throughout the Islamic world, everyone is at war, because they're at war with God and the IMF. So I just wanted to put that in. The tragedy is that Muslims are now doing exactly what the Prophet warned them that they would do, and that riba interest would dominate. They would build arrogantly tall buildings, which they're now doing throughout the world, and the barefoot and the destitute will compete with one another building them. So the fulfillment, unfortunately, is that the Muslims have no excuse. The Quran is the most explicit in promising them war and conflict while ever they practice something. Because remember, interest in Islamic Sharia jurisprudence is considered to be 30 times worse than committing incest with your mother in the Kaaba, in the Holy of Holies. That's the least of 30. In a scale of 1 to 30, it's the very least. So even murder doesn't equate with interest, because from interest and debt, all the other crimes and destructions come. It is the root of all the problems.
And we do see a rise in America in gambling, in vulgarity, in sexual mores being relaxed, in sickness throughout the society, and in here in the West, as in the Western Europe as well.
Look, There are two other quotes. Jefferson, fantastic. Lincoln, perfect. Everybody understood the problem. I can quote you from all the presidents. They understood better than anybody. But look at there are two other statements that are very important. Imam Ali, the cousin of the Prophet Muhammad, says, "We withstood the weight of the iron, the stone, and the lash, but found the hardest thing to endure, burden of debt." Now, if the Prophet's families cannot bear the burden of debt, no individual on the face of the earth can bear it with equanimity or even bear it at all. So they must escape into alcohol, gambling, anything that just gives them that instant of relief from the pressure. Then, of course, Jefferson made the same statement. But look, Napoleon, you're in France. The greatest liberator of Europe was actually Napoleon, contrary to what we believe, of course, has been brought up as British or whatever. But Napoleon, when he saw the debt of France, he made this statement. He was a great gunnery officer, and he was also a great theologian. He understood very, very well all the implications of the Bible and the fact that the Holy Land included Arabia, not just Palestine. But he said, "The deadly facts herein reveal that it is amazing that this monster interest has not devoured all humanity. It would have done so long ago had not bankruptcy and terrorism acted as counter poisons." Now, this was, of course, the civil law of France, the civil code, Code Napoleon, is 94% Islamic. It is entirely just translated from the fiqh of Imam Malik. So Napoleon converted to Islam in 1798. He took the name Ali Bonaparte, but where is that in your history book? I've got it in my history book that I've written and translated. And James Gibb Stewart, the man who wrote The Money Bomb, translated that book because once he knew that Napoleon had outlawed usury, because he said all the wars with England have been wars of usury, and the battle in India with Tipu Sultan, etc. So the key is that there is an understanding that whoever writes history, as Napoleon said, it is comprised of lies which are no longer contested. We have to contest them.
Well, you take a look at this present situation, and you were actually involved in a precursing event that you actually discussed in the beginning of this discussion here, where there was a serious implosion in the mid-90s of the Asian tigers, and everyone remembers those Asian tigers of Malaysia and Philippines and Indonesia and so forth. And at that time, everybody was declaring the only out they had, the only solution they had, was to sign up to International Monetary Fund and the World Bank's solution for this debt relief. And what that was to place the country's tangible assets into the hands of these bankers, as well as a management system. What happened when you guys got together with Mohammed Rafik and others to bring Mahathir Mohammed a solution? And James Gibb Stewart and others from the Broomsgrove Group, what did you offer to him that would solve this problem, at least in the short term?
Well, I can tell you precisely what happened. I had been working in Malaysia on the Twin Towers with Peter Walker and also in the Marina Mandarin Hotel in Singapore on the alternative access systems. I was introduced to the then secretary to the prime minister and related to something else. And I attended a conference there basically on Islamic banking, then by the same person who I introduced then to Mohammed Rafik and other members of the Forum for Stable Currencies, and James Gibb Stewart and myself, Ken Palmerton, and others were involved. And I passed then the information to his secretary, principal private secretary to Mr. Prime Minister Mahathir. And with it, I gave him the book that I was then finishing, Napoleon and Islam, which was published in Malaysia by Utusan Publishers. And then I also gave him the American Constitution and, of course, Lincoln's Declaration of 1867 or 1865. And from that, I was then asked to prepare a plan of how to defend Malaysia. That was put together over 4 days, and I flew then to Malaysia with it, and I presented it personally to Prime Minister at the Langkawi Air Show. Once he had that, he then appointed Mr. Norbin Yaqub, who was then running a company called Mamoun, who is now the current Minister for Finance. He is the one who implemented what had been recommended by James Gistewart and the Bromsgrove Group, our group that formed the stable currencies, which was basically to not to allow the sell-off of the assets and to stop trading after hours because there was and to stop trading in the currency. But also, there was an hour later in Singapore, they were putting the bets on after the markets had closed in Kuala Lumpur. So it's like if you knew what's national, you know, it's good you can put all your money on after when you know you've got an hour to put the bet on after the race is run. So in a nutshell, James Gibbs-Stewart gave the perfect solution, which he'd given elsewhere. He put together everything, and I delivered to Mahathir. And it's on a very good CD that was in Getting the World Bank Out of Our Country or Your Country by James Gibbs-Stewart. When Mahathir was interviewed later by, I think it was The Spectator, or an article appeared, I Did It My Way, he made no mention to any of the help he'd received from James Gibbs-Stewart or the guys here. But the point was that we know for sure that there is a way you can defeat Shylock and his boys. But in this case, it was George Soros. But then there's a marvelous article by George Soros that was in The Guardian called The Palindrome Repents, in which he said, well, if you allow me to do this, then you're foolish. So he was really criticizing governments for permitting after-hours betting or the actual ability to actually not bail out your own companies, and that they're just sold off to the bailiffs. Now, remember, Oliver Cromwell was the best, was a bailiff man, so was Margaret Thatcher.
Yep. Well, Mahathir has not been forthcoming lately in the defense of the battle out here. I haven't seen him. He's getting older in years. Is Malaysia still adhering to the principles that he laid down when he was prime minister? Because simply he doesn't hold the same sway he once did. Are they inching their way back into control of Malaysia as well?
Well, I tried to see Ms. Norbin Yaqub when I went back a few months ago, but I couldn't get to see him. But basically, what I was comfortable with was the fact that we had managed to interdict or interfere with something and show that there is an alternative way, that there is a way of surviving. And everybody criticized Mahathir at the time, but we stood with him and kept and held his hand, and he did the right thing.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we've known the problem for thousands of years, but unfortunately, each generation has to reinvent the wheel or has to relearn, because there's no cumulative wisdom passed on to each generation, because we're not allowed to teach the subject in any university in the world today, regardless of whether it's in an Islamic country or elsewhere for that matter.
Well, David, you know as well as I do that this forum that you're participating in right now presents this kind of information regularly. And what my goal is here is to have a base of knowledge that people can carry with them that can be documented and held in trust for their future needs, because, frankly, I see what we face right now. And subprime is only the spark that lit this fire. You know as well as I do that this derivatives nonsense and this new banking regime that has been signed on by the world in Switzerland is going to be probably the worst of all of our financial implosions, because for the first time, it's not a country or a region imploding, it's the entire world economy. And why? Because we are when you take over the entire world's economy with this debt-based banking system in the hands of the same people, if their system implodes, David, everyone goes with it.
Of course, unless you have something in place in anticipation of it. And many people have already put things in place. And two ladies who started the Stroud Pound Scheme, one was an Irish girl, the other one was an English lady called Maggie Mills, they started their own the Stroud Pound Scheme. And every society, every community should have, like they've been in Ithaca, they have in the States, now 60 other towns and cities, you have a local currency, a currency that is issued by the town. So it doesn't matter if everything collapses. The hens still lay eggs. The cows give milk. Therefore, what is stopping us exchanging things? But we need a medium of exchange that is something that is issued. And it would happen in Vergel in Austria in 1932. They solved unemployment. They had basically, within 6 months, everything was back to normal. And then Unter Guggenberger and all the people who had gone into the scheme were put in prison, and the bank, the Central Bank of Austria, so its monopoly being eroded. And, of course, Hitler came to power on the back of 6 million unemployed, caused because purely that the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England had rearmed Hitler and brought him to power through the ballot box by depressing the economy. It's clear and very clear how it's done, and it's happened throughout history in the same way. And in fact, World War II was predicted by Silvio Gesell in 1918, when they were signing the peace conference in Zeitung am Mittag. He made this statement. When they're signing the peace treaty, he said, in spite of the holy promises of people to banish war once and for all, and in spite of the cry of millions, never again war, in spite of the hopes of a better future, I dare to predict today we'll have another war in less than 25 years. And he goes on to explain how it will happen. I can foresee the coming developments clearly. The present degree of technological advancement will quickly result in a record performance of industry. The buildup of capital will be fast in spite of the enormous losses during the war, and through the oversupply of money, the interest rate will be lowered until money speculators refuse to lower their rates any further. Money will then be hoarded, causing predictable deflation. Economic activities will diminish, and increasing numbers of unemployed persons will roam the streets. Within these discontented masses, wild revolutionary ideas will arise, and with it also the poisonous plant called supranationalism will proliferate. No country will understand the other, and the end can only be war again. Did it not happen exactly according to that?
So it did.
The outcome is quickly known. And of course, Gesell, it was his model that they followed in Austria and elsewhere in the world. And he understood that the key is the power of any state or any local government is to issue its own money into circulation and leave it. And that way you can break all the control. You can survive even when the money bomb drops.
Now, Churchill understood this early on and then seemingly did a reversal. It seems like he was anti-bankers for a while, and he understood the concept of debt being the burden that the society was going to be sunk by. And then all of a sudden, he comes to power in advance of the Second World War and begins to sending Britain into indebtedness that had reached records. What happened between his 1920s positions and his 1940s positions?
Well, I can tell you precisely that because I had the opportunity, and Mr. Swan, who I'm finishing this book for, who, by the way, went to prison under Regulation 18B for saying, as the Bank of England, Montague Norman, has rearmed Germany, and the Bush family and the Walker family have rearmed Germany as well, why was he expected to go and fight? So he was locked up under Regulation 18B with Archibald Moore Ramsey and loads of other guys who were considered to be lunatics. Some of them may have had quite strong views, but the point was that they did understand the problem was a monetary one, and it was all engineered to bring about world control. Now, Churchill was going to hang the governor of the Bank of England, and I have the statement made by the retired governor of the Bank of England, who quoted my letter to him in Pescatore in Switzerland on the fact that Churchill was going to hang the governor of the Bank of England for treason because he put it on the gold standard. If you go to Hansard, volume 264, April 21st, 1932, this is what Churchill said. When I was moved by many arguments and forces in 1925 to return to the gold standard, I was assured by the highest experts that we were anchoring ourselves to reality and stability, and I accepted their advice. I take for myself and my colleagues of other days whatever degree of blame and burden they may be for having accepted that advice. But what has happened? We have had no reality, no stability. The price of gold has suddenly risen since by 70%, more than 70%. That is as if a 12-inch rule had suddenly stretched to 19 or 20 inches, as if the pound avoirdupois had suddenly become 23 or 24 ounces. Look at what this has meant to everybody who has been compelled to execute their contracts upon this irrationally enhanced scale. Look at the gross unfairness of such distortions on all producers of new wealth, and look at the enormous increase in volume of commodities which have to be created to pay off the same mortgage debt. Like subprime, this is subprime, but an earlier version. It's, now, I'll come It's the same, but it's the same problem. The disease is AIDS, financial AIDS, acquired investment deficiency syndrome. That's what we've got. Now, he goes on to say then, and look at the enormous increased volumes of commodities which have to be created to pay off the same mortgage debt or loans. Minor fluctuations might well be ignored, but I quite seriously have to say today that if this monetary convolution has now reached such a pitch that I am prepared, persuaded that the producers of new wealth will not tolerate indefinitely so hideous an oppression. Now, is that not a very strong statement?
Well, it is, and here he is in the 1940s actually working within the system, because he knew full well that this was an engineered conflict.
Yeah, but he knew that the British Empire was being taken over by America, and this was part of the deal. And when Baruch called him, remember, Baruch called him, and he watched the stock market go down, and the order was the British Empire, there will be no British Empire, no Commonwealth, and that was why Churchill buckled under. He wanted to try and at least retain something of what he believed was worth fighting for. So it was part of this, and there's nothing like a death sentence to concentrate the mind. So he was silent and had to go along with the powers that be, which were the Rothschilds, the same, the Warburg, and they were in control. And the American Empire then, did you see the End of Empire series? It was very good. But, of course, China is now the next piece in the puzzle, as the protocols say. You know, we'll use the arms of China and Japan, and China has yet to be used.
So, well, you see, David, one of the interesting things is that what the American public doesn't understand, they think that our country goes forward with that wonderful Constitution that you so aptly quote. But in fact, it's not the Constitution or the constitutional values that are represented by the American government, but rather a small select group of very wealthy Zionist Jews who have monopolized both media and money to affect a pseudo control of the world. And these same forces under Morgenthau and Brandeis and even Ben Friedman back in his day, before he saw the light. I mean, Ben Friedman took part in this stuff until he saw the light. But we had a guy named Untermyer involved, and we had, you know, we had all of these people, Morgenthau and Baruch, as you mentioned. These people were henchmen for these international bankers through Harriman Bank and through Morgan's Bank, J.P. Morgan's Bank. Of course, Morgan was a Rothschild plant as well.